formation where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.
The Occult History of the Windsors. Terry Liddell of the South London Republican Forum explores some alleged connections between the British royal family, Freemasonry, Jack the Ripper, and the death of Princess Diana. Recorded at the Anarchist Heretics Fair, Brighton, on Saturday, May the 6th, 2000.
South London Republican Forum. What I wanted to talk about was virtually the entire history of the Windsor dynasty. But as I'm only got an hour, I'm going to have to truncate it a bit. So what I'm going to concentrate on is, I think, two major events in the history of the House of Windsor. The first of those is the Jack the Ripper murders, which took place in East London in the last century. And the second is a more recent event, which is the demise of Diana, Princess of Wales. Now, the British monarchy is a very peculiar institution. Like its continental counterparts, officially it's a constitutional monarchy. But in Britain, it's a monarchy without a written constitution. Furthermore, it's a monarchy which, if you actually read the coinage, rules die gratia, literally by the grace of God. And indeed, there are those who claim that the monarchy or the royal family is in some way linked with the bloodline of Jesus of Nazareth, or Jesus Christ as it's called by Christians. Also as well, the British monarchy has a very close relationship with that peculiar institution called Freemasonry. And since King Edward VII, every Prince of Wales except the present one has been a past Grand Master of English Freemasonry. Also as well, every male member of the royal family is circumcised. And they're not circumcised by a doctor, as one would be if one was circumcised for health reasons. They're actually circumcised by a Jewish ritual circumciser. I forget what the Yiddish word for that is off the top of my head. So already we begin some strange, peculiar links here, which make the British monarchy a very peculiar institution. It's quite interesting as well, but looking at The Simpsons on TV last night, they had a lovely skit on Freemasonry, where the Freemasons are called the Stonecutters, and they're singing this song, and the first line of it was, "We are the power behind the British crown." So I don't know if ever does The Simpsons has put out some messages there. Anyway, on to the two main topics of my talk. First of all, the Jack the Ripper murders. Between August and November 1888, five women were killed in the Whitechapel area of East London. They were Mary Nichols, Annie Chapman, Elizabeth Stride, Catherine Eddowes, and finally Mary Kelly. They were not only murdered in that they had their throats cut, they were also subject to pretty horrific mutilations as well. At that time in London, there were something like 80,000 prostitutes. Poverty forcing many women into full-time or part-time prostitution. In the Whitechapel area where the murders took place, there were over 1,000 prostitutes operating from some 62 brothels. 47% of the population lived in dire poverty. In that part of London, unlike the big towns of the Midlands and the North, there was no industrial base. So work, very often when it was available, tended to be casual works. For men, things like working on the docks where you work by the day. The men fought at the dock gates for a day's work. And very small-scale industries as well, things like sweet making and box making. Venereal disease and alcoholism, sex and drink being the main ways of escaping from this for working class people, were right. There were a whole number of suspects for the Jack the Ripper murders. One of these was Montague Druitt, a teacher in Blackheath, funnily enough, not far from where I live, who allegedly committed suicide by drowning, at least his body was fished out of the Thames. There was Kaminski, a Polish Jew, and at that time there was a large influx of Jewish immigrants from the Tsar's Empire into East London. They were fleeing from the pogroms, which resulted from the assassination of the Tsar in 1881. There was another Jew called Aaron Cohen, who also died in an asylum. in 1888. It's very strange the number of people involved in the Ripper murders who do not die of natural causes. They tend to go insane and die in asylums, or they tend to allegedly commit suicide. Sir Melville McNaughton, who is the chief constable at Scotland Yard, writing some years later in the Daily Mail in 1913, said that he had destroyed all the documents and there is no record of the secret information which came into his possession. It's a very peculiar admission from a chief constable that he's actually destroyed evidence about horrific murders. It's also very strange that no action is taken at all against this man. Nobody seems to bat an eyelid or turn a hair. Now, my contention is that the Ripper murders were a cover-up, and that the person whose misdeeds was being covered up was Albert Edward Victor Christian, who was the Duke of Clarence. He was also the heir to the throne as well, being the eldest son of King Edward VII, who at that time was still Prince of Wales, Victoria being very much alive and on the throne. Eddie, as he was called, so that's what I'll call him, inherited his mother's profound deafness. He was also very poorly educated and was generally regarded as backward and was regarded as a bit of a joke in the royal family. The allegation by a number of authors is that through the artist Walter Sicker, Eddie met a commoner called Annie Cook, who, amongst various occupations, modelled for Sicker. In 1885, it is known that Annie gave birth to a daughter, Alice, in the workhouse at Marylebone. It has been alleged, though there's no concrete proof of this, that Eddie and Annie Cook went through both Anglican marriage ceremonies and Roman Catholic marriage ceremonies, Annie being of the Catholic persuasion. Of course, all of this is contrary to the settlement after the demise of the Stuarts of the British monarchy. So it was contrary to the Bill of Rights of 1689, it was contrary to the Act of Settlement of 1701, which had been specifically designed to keep Catholics off of the throne. And it was also contrary to the Royal Marriages Act, which basically meant that anybody who stood in line for the throne could not contract a marriage without the consent of the ruler and monarch. There's more people coming up the stairs. Right, okay. It's all right.
Some more chairs.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm just getting into this. I think we have to remember at this time in the 1880s that the monarchy was far from secure. There had been 6 assassination attempts on Queen Victoria. Shortly before this, in the 1870s, inspired by the Paris Commune, there was a very strong republican movement in this country, which I've actually written about in our pamphlet downstairs, called The Republic Must Come. In 1886, in a period of depression, there'd been riots and mass demonstrations by the unemployed, which had been led by the newborn socialist movements, organisations like the Social Democratic Federation of Henry Hindman and the Socialist League of William Norris. That year also there'd been the Bloody Sunday events. The police had banned demonstrations in Trafalgar Square. Sounds very familiar, doesn't it, that? And the radicals, who were the working class wing of liberalism, the socialists, and of course the Irish, had got together to defy this ban. They marched from all over London. There was street fighting. And one person, and possibly two, were killed as a result of this. And many people thought that the year 1889, the centenary of the French Revolution, would see a revolution of similar dimensions and similar consequences in this country. If we now look at the institution of Freemasonry and the role of Masonry, and this will become obvious later on, Edward, then the Prince of Wales, was the Grand Master of Masonry in England. And I should perhaps point out that whereas continental Masonry was atheist, republican, and generally subversive, English Masonry, since the time of the Stuarts, had been very much tied up with the establishment of the monarchy. And indeed, when Edward became the past Grand Master, Charles Bradlaugh, who had been seen by some as potentially the first Republican President of England, resigned from Masonry. Eddie himself had been initiated into the Royal Alpha Lodge No. 16 in 1885. Now, Annie Crook, who he allegedly married, was a friend of Mary, was a friend of a woman called Mary Kelly, who may have been nanny at one time to Annie Crook's, allegedly Eddie's daughter. Annie Crook, was on the way to Dry's Hospital. She spent the rest of her life either in workhouses or in institutions for the insane. It was alleged that she'd become insane because she'd been tortured by Sir William Gull. William Gull was the physician both to Queen Victoria and to Eddie. She finally died insane in the institution in 1920. Mary Kelly, fearful of what the consequences of her association to Crook might be, fled into anonymity in the Whitechapel area of the East End. In 1888, it seems that she got together with three other women who worked as prostitutes to blackmail Sickert. Sickert in turn informed Eddie, who in turn informed the then Prime Minister of the time, Lord Salisbury, a high Tory, an extreme reactionary. Salisbury then ordered a cover-up. And the person who he put in charge of the job was Randolph Churchill. Randolph Churchill was the father of Sir Winston Churchill. Randolph Churchill was a right-wing Conservative MP, one of the people who led the opposition of Bradlaugh being admitted to Parliament because Bradlaugh would not take a religious oath of allegiance to Queen Victoria. Randolph Churchill was probably syphilitic. He certainly was mentally unstable, and his mental instability was not at all helped by the fact that he took large quantities of laudanum, a distillate of opium, to deal with the pain that he was suffering from. Also involved in the cover-up was Sir William Gull, as I said, the physician to Queen Victoria and Eddie. Gull recruited a man called John Netley, who was a cab driver, who'd driven Eddie to his trysts with Annie Crook. What seems to, also involved in this as well was a man called J.K. Stephen, who had been Eddie's tutor. Their modus operandi was that what they did was they lured prostitutes, or the women they were looking for, to silence them, into a coach driven by Netley, and then killed them. And of course, because of their connections with masonry, they were killed in a way which anybody in the know would realise was the kind of ritual executions laid down in the pretty horrific oaths that Freemasons swore at that time. It's interesting to know that the last of the murders took place on the 9th of November, which happened to be Edward's birthday. The Commissioner of Metropolitan Police at that time was a man called Sir Charles Warren, who himself was a legal Freemason. He was founder of the Quattor Coronati, probably Latin translation of lodge, which is basically a lodge which does research into the history of Masons. He was also a past Grand Sojourner of the Supreme Grand Chapter of Masonry. Apart from that, he was quite a well-known archaeologist who'd served in the British military in the Middle East and Africa. And he was the person responsible for the suppression of the Bloody Sunday demonstrations. Finally, after he retired from the Metropolitan Police, he became a military commander in South Africa and China. Then he stayed doing things with Boy Scouts. Right. On a tenement wall in East London near the site of the fourth killing, a message had been chalked, and it said the Jewes, spelled G-U-W-E-S, are the men that will not be blamed for nothing. Warren, when he saw this, had it immediately washed off, and that this message had ever been written was concealed by Scotland Yard for 90 years. The last of the killings took place in Mitre Square, and of course, as you may know, the Mitre is a Masonic symbol, and indeed on the square was a pub called the Mitre Tavern, which was used for Masonic markings. Also, there's what looked like Masonic symbols carved into the face of one of the victims, and a piece of apron had been found. And once again, of course, the apron plays a role in Masonic ceremony. Churchill himself also was a leading Mason as well. It was alleged that Eddie had died of influenza in January 1892. And his brother, George, who later ruled as George V, became heir to the throne. What was known was that at the age of 13 that he had had typhoid, of which God had cured him. It was also known that Eddie was a bisexual and was known in the gay circles as the son of Victoria, after his grandmother. Now, Alistair Crowley, who some of you may know of, claimed to have letters from Eddie to a boy named Morgan, who lived in Cleveland Street, which is the site of a well-known gay brothel. Involved in the gay brothel was a lay preacher called Beck, who was based at St. Saviour's in Maple Street, where one of Eddie's alleged marriages took place. The patrons of the gay brothel nicknamed Eddie Collar and Cuffs, and Le Butcher, who was a radical Republican MP, was the paper called Truth and Surgeons, the newspaper. George ended up marrying Mary of Teck, who had been Eddie's fiancée. However, there's allegations that, in fact, Eddie didn't die, but was interned in Glamis Castle in Scotland, the home of the Beau Ryan's family, until he died later. The payoff was that Elizabeth, our beloved Queen Mum, who will soon reach her centenary, got married off to George VI. Walter Sickert's son Charles, apparently, and this becomes even more convoluted, allegedly replaced John, the son of George V and Mary, who died. Incidentally, he was the only member of the royal family not to have been buried at Windsor. Alice, that's Annie Cook, Eddie's alleged daughter, survived attempts by Netley to do her in. And also she married a man called William Gorman, to make it even more convoluted, and alleged connections with the Irish Republican Army. Netley himself died, apparently, from falling off his coach and being killed by being kicked in the head by one of his own horses. And curiously, he died near Clarence Gate, Regent's Park. And of course, Eddie was the Duke of Clarence. J.K. Stevens, if you're involved, it was died mad in an asylum in 1892. Queen Alexandra, Eddie's mother, may well know of his marriage, because shortly before her death in 1925, she gave some of her jewellery to Alice, his daughter. Also, as well, to make it even more interesting, she may have committed adultery with the Grand Duke Nicholas of Russia, who was the brother of the future Tsar. And indeed, if you look at pictures of George V and Nicholas II, they look actually more like brothers than the close relatives they're supposed to have been. George V died on, when George V was dying, he was allegedly given a lethal injection because he started raving and begging Eddie's forgiveness. George may have known of Churchill's attempts to kill Eddie by shoving him over the side of the cliff. Netley was involved in this as well. Also, as well, it's thought that Netley, in his search for Kelly, had mistaken her for somebody else and killed a woman called Emma Smith in 1888. And to silence this woman, had actually beat her to a pulp and had also shoved a broken pot into her vagina. It's also thought that the treatment of Eddie may have been a factor in the abdication of Edward VIII, as well as his relationship with Mrs. Simpson. A final twist is that it may not have been Kelly who had been killed. Kelly may have been a police informer who was helped to escape to Canada, where she had children. Certainly the cover-up continues. The home of Joseph Sickert, Walter Sickert's son, was raided by the special branch, or persons claiming to be the special branch, looking for the diaries of Inspector Abilene, who'd been involved in the case, and also photographs of the victims which had come into Joseph's possession. So then you have the Jack the Ripper murders. Police, it seems, could not catch the perpetrator of these murders at all. And like I said, my contention is that, in fact, it was a cover-up for the misdeeds of Eddie, perpetrated by people who were cemented together by the bond of Freemasonry. Well, now comes a more recent case, which is that of Diana. As you may remember, what were called the Squidgy Gate tapes, which were a record of a telephone conversation between Diana and a car dealer called James Gilly, who was obviously besotted with her, and he referred to her many times as darling or to squidging. These tapes were far too sophisticated to be the work of amateur eavesdroppers, which was alleged. Also as well, you have what are called the Camillagate tapes, which is the famous conversation between Charles and Camilla Parker Bowles, where Charles said that he wanted to be reincarnated as a tampon.
Indeed, yes.
Curious. Also, as well, this time, Charles had Kensington Palace threat for Bowles, not by the security forces, but by a private firm, which would tend to indicate that he did not trust his own security forces. A very dubious chap called Oswald Le Winter, who'd worked for the CIA, claimed to have documents proving that the CIA and MI6 had conspired together to murder Diana. The official version of this was that it was a hoax. A well-known criminal called Peter Scott claimed that there'd been attempts to recruit him to murder the Al-Fayed family because he, for some peculiar reason, because he'd known Diana's mother for some 40 years. And the hitman on this job was to be Russell Grant, vicar, who of course is the son of the well-known villain John McVicar. There's also a very large question mark as well over the blood test, which you may remember when they did the autopsy on the driver. It was alleged that they found large amounts of alcohol and also psychotropic drugs in his blood system, though he wasn't known as a heavy drinker or as a drug user. There's been some very peculiar cases as well in this country of unsolved murders. You may remember the case of Hilda Mole, the anti-nuclear campaigner who was murdered. You may remember the case of William McCrae, the Scottish nationalist, who had alleged links to the Scottish National Liberation Army, who was supposed to have committed suicide by shooting himself twice, in the head. A remarkable feat if you shot yourself once in the head. It also had the situation as well of the shoot to kill policy against Irish Republicans in the north of Ireland. And you may remember the whole involvement of this stalker and how stalker was thrown out of his job. And you've also had proven collusion between the Crown Security Forces in the north of Ireland and loyalist gunmen to murder Republicans and members of the national community. And to go back to the Nipper case for a moment, establishment historians, the latest example of which is an article in History Today in the May 2000 issue, by a chap who teaches in Wales called William Rubinstein, to totally discredit any royal involvement in the Ripper murders. He describes this theory as palpable nonsense, because on the basis of the fact that Clarence was in Scotland and York at the time of the murders, now nobody says that Clarence was the murderer. What people are saying is that various people led by Randolph Churchill conspired to murder the women involved who were allegedly blackmailing the Duke of Clarence. He also compares the Masonic link theory with the protocols of the Elders of Zion, which of course are discredited as historical documents, and therefore, if you like, is discrediting another theory on the basis of dubious association. He believes that the murderer was a man called James Braidwick, who surprisingly also died unnaturally, being allegedly poisoned by his wife. Strangely enough, although his wife was sentenced to death, she was reprieved and did 15 years in prison. The whole basis of this theory is, in fact, on documents which many think are forgeries. And one wonders, and this is, in fact, another aspect of the whole cover-up of this thing. In our own time, I think we can draw many historical parallels between the time of the Ripper murders and our own period. Obviously, we live in a period of economic crisis, of great insecurity. The image of the monarchy has become tarnished. They're no longer the repository of all known bourgeois virtues, a kind of soap opera fairy tale. They've been riddled by scandal, and indeed have been revealed to be an adulterous, argumentative, dysfunctional family. Well, if they lived on a housing estate in South East London, they would probably be plagued by social workers for the rest of their days. You've also seen the growth of republicanism, and indeed in one television poll conducted by Carlton TV, the majority of people in Scotland were in favour of the Republic, with substantial minorities in England and Wales. We've also seen the need as well of the establishment to revive the image of the monarchy, all the brouhaha and hysteria around the death of Diana, and all the bollocksology about the people's princess
and even the sort of quasi-religious cults around us. You also see Tony Blair carry out what seemingly is a constitutional revolution with assemblies for Scotland and Wales. This, I think, was done not because Blair believes in devolution, but purely to head off what I think was a process which was beginning, which was the breakup of the United Kingdom. Right, so what I've tried to show is, in brief, and I'm almost running out of time now, is that the royal family can literally get away with murder, possibly at least 6 murders. That there is an establishment cemented together by Freemasonry which penetrates all areas of life, but particularly politics and particularly policing in this country, which, because of its own vested interests, wants to maintain the monarchy. I'm a Republican. I'll describe myself as a Republican communist. What I want to see is what is now the United Kingdom, or perhaps the untied kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, workers' republics. I want to see Ireland reunited into a 32-county socialist republic as fought for by James Connolly and others in 1916. So I think the days of the monarchy are numbered. I think if these things can be exposed to what they've done, then their image will finally fall apart. And, as they say in 1066 and all that, that would be a good thing.
So you may already have mentioned it, but I did hear pretty recently that Blair's going to the country a year early because it doesn't want to clash with the what's-her-name shenanigans.
That's perfectly right, yes, because it's whatever it is, the...
50 years.
50 years, that's it, that's right. Herself will have been on the throne 50 years. And apparently she's sort of had words with him that she sort of doesn't want discord and mayhem and all sorts of unpleasantness to mar the celebrations of the 50 years. So Mr. Blair will have to go to the country early if he loses the serving right. Because if you actually look at what the founders of the Labour Party, particularly Keir Hardie, had to say about the monarchy, and the dreadful sycophancy, I suppose in this sort of last living, this is perfectly all right to say, of Tony Blair, you know, the contrast is absolutely total. Anyway, this is just good. We'll get a general election a year early.
How do you respond to Charles's positive opposition to the establishment last year as genetically modified foods? Is he out of control?
Well, I mean, sometimes you wonder about Charles. You know, I wonder about him. I think basically he's a person who, by an accident of birth, is going to be lumped with a job that really in his heart he doesn't want. I think he'd be much happier if he went off to be a gentleman organic farmer somewhere, married Parker Bowles, and they could bolt themselves into a stupor, and nobody would give a damn, and he'd be a lot happier doing that. Unfortunately, because the British establishment needs the monarchy, and is fearful of what might happen even if you had a constitutional republic. After all, these people, when they go to public school, do read history. That he's going to be lumbered with this job. I think that if he had the Cody's convictions, he'd just say, well, get somebody else to do it. I'm abdicating. It may well be as well that looking at historical precedent, he may well find himself abdicating. I mean, after all, he's... one of his brothers looks like he's going to remarry Sarah Ferguson, and his other brother, so far, that young Edward, doesn't seem to have cocked up his marriage, and indeed has become the Duke of Wessex as well. Oh, I'm sure the Wessex regents will have to say something about that. Anyway, that's what I think. I think Charlie does get out of control occasionally, but as long as his father's alive, I think his father just, you know, slaps him down and keeps him under control. He's had a poor lad got to marry poor old Diana in the first place. Right.
You mentioned about circumcision in the royal family. Whether do you believe that there's a Jewish connection or some relationship?
I don't think there's a Jewish connection as such. I think the royal family bases itself upon the old, the Jewish kings of the old two kingdoms of Israel and Judea. After all, they're the only kings in Europe to be anointed with oil, as were the old Davidic kings. in Judaism and Israel. And it's interesting because being anointed by all, that makes them messiahs. The literal translation of messiah from the Hebrew is somebody who's anointed. Nothing at all to do, anything to do with religions or claims to be the son of God. I think they actually based themselves on that. As I said, there was this theory that they, in some way they're vaguely related to the bloodline of Jesus, but some of them, they themselves may well believe that, or some of their ideologues may believe that. And of course they also have a religious role as the heads of the Church of England as well. So, as the Irish say, that had nothing to do with theology and a lot to do with the dangling parts of Edward VIII. But anyway, they still have this role. I don't think it's a Jewish collection, but I do think that consciously or unconsciously they base themselves on the old Davidic kings.
Is it true that I read somewhere that most presidents of the United States are related to the British royal family?
No, I don't think so. No, it'd have to be a very sort of far removed relationship. Because as far as I know, no one at all ever went to America, even very distant family.
Well, it's a sort of esoteric secret that most presidents are actually blood related.
Well, it's something I've not seen at all. What I do know is that an awful lot of presidents of the United States have been Freemasons.
Yeah, I mean, it's research done by someone called John Coleman. I don't know if you're familiar.
No, I'm not.
He wrote a book called The Committee of 300.
I've heard of the book.
Yeah, and also, dare I say it, David Icke. I don't know if you're familiar with his books, and The Truth Will Set You Free, and Biggest Secret.
Well, I mean, as far as I know, Icke tends to believe that the royal family are, what's it, reptilian shapeshifters.
Yeah, I mean, that's nonsense.
I hope they're cold-blooded, but I think that's taking it a bit far.
Yeah. But I mean, yeah, he's lost the plot there, but he has done, to say the least, he has done some research that could be valuable in what you're saying. And I don't think you should, because he's lost the plot there, throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Well, I've not actually read his book, possibly because I read reviews of it, which concentrated on the reptilian shapeshifters thing. And I thought, what can you possibly say?
There's a lot in there about the murder of Lady Diana. I mean, in the book, And the Truth Set You Free, he sort of says that Karl Marx was related as well to the aristocracy.
Karl Marx was actually related to the Dukes of Argyll.
Right.
Through his wife.
Yeah, that's right.
Because it's the famous story that when they were skint, which was a usual condition for the Marx family, well, until Edmunds could fork up, they went off to pawn the silver. And of course the silver had the crest of the Dukes of Argyll on it, and the pawnbroker thought, well, that this impoverished, hairy-looking Jew coming in with this has obviously pinched it, and they had Karl Marx lifted. But he was related through his wife very badly to the Dukes of Argyll.
But the British state was sort of patrons of him, sort of writing his death capital in the British Museum, weren't they?
I don't think the British state was, I think Fred Engels was. And I don't think the British state was even vaguely aware that he was sitting there with carbuncles on his bum, writing Das Kapitel, or indeed doing anything very much.
Anyway, last of his New Statesman, there was a cartoon of the Focus, the Simon Seekers. Did you see that?
No, I didn't know.
You know the little one at the Fred Niblett at the end?
Yeah.
And that had Phil the Greek and Elizabeth Hasco.
Well, that's fine. The chap from the Wessex Regents, somewhere they sort of, supposedly trace it back to the old Anglo-Saxon kings of back in the mists of time. But of course, the present dynasty was actually brought over here to fill a gap, because they'd run out of Stuarts. Queen Anne had no male heirs. You'd had William and Mary. And interestingly, William's campaign against James II, or Seamus the Shrett as they called him in Ireland because he ran away, was fundrolled by sort of assorted bankers who got as their reward control of the Bank of England. But anyway, they'd run out of that bloodline, and I think through some vague connection to Sophie of Hanover, and because I suppose the Hanovers were a bit unemployed and needed a good job, they were brought over here. And sort of gradually become anglicised, though even as late as George V they still spoke German in the court as opposed to English as well. But obviously, as they say, I mean, let's face it, they have the best rate of social security payments in the country. And I think anybody who's a social security payment should be demanding parity.
Okay, we know two things about Jack Ripper. One, he was Yes.
And secondly, he was a Freemason, which would tend to suggest that it was really with the God, but again, there's
no solid evidence. But on the other hand, because of the way the mutilations were carried out, he would have had to have a fair degree of anatomical knowledge,
sure.
Which also tends to rule out school teachers or sort of, poor Jewish workers.
So we dismiss that. But that also says that the Masons are not at all in favour of Charles succeeding to the throne. And so it seems unlikely that his arch enemy, i.e. Diana, she could have been done away with by an establishment in which the Freemasons do that an awful lot of clout. You think that they would be protecting her because with her around, it's always very much more difficult for Charles to actually have any kind of support in the country to succeed at the throne.
I think the reason why Diana was done away with was because of her relationship with Dauphine. Now, there was a theory, I've seen the evidence for this, that she was actually pregnant by him at the time of her demise. Now, if she'd have had children, or a child, it would have been very embarrassing for the establishment to have somebody who would, albeit quite removed, but possibly in line for the throne, and certainly half-brothers to the heir of the throne, who were not white. And also the Muslim religion as well. Obviously Charles, as I said, is the first Prince of Wales since Edward VII not to be a Freemason, despite the fact that Phil the Greek has tried to get him to go for all the leg-bearing rigmarole and whatnot. And it could well be that, like I said, the Masonic establishment doesn't want Charles to be king, or perhaps prefer one of his brothers. I think, like I said, I think that's the reason why they got rid of Diana as well.
I think that was why there was all that talk of the monarchy skipping a generation going straight to one of Diana's children.
Well, that's right, either to William or Henry. It's quite interesting as well that they're actually being boosted, well, certainly the eldest one is now. It could well be, as I said, that Charles could find himself abdicated, much like his uncle was.
What about his sort of New Age aspirations? Like he said that he wants to be defender of faiths in a pluralistic sense rather than defender of the faith, and that if he had a coronation service, he'd have a blessing from people from all different religions. And
well, I mean, he could, strictly speaking, he will still be head of the Church of England as the legislation stands at the moment. Quite clearly, I think he's fallen down a bit on theology, particularly the commandment which says thou shalt not commit adultery. But obviously he could do that, but he would still have to, unless the Church of England was disestablished. And once again, you need great constitutional changes there. There would be a lot of resistance to this, I think, because of the ideological world that the Church...
Yeah, given the ecumenical climate, like within Christendom and the interfaith movement, there's a way of accommodating it, isn't there? Without overtly undermining the Christian faith as such, the establishment religion, whatever.
It could be done, but I think you'd get resistance because of the role that the Church of England has played. It's also quite interesting as well that you now have a lot of high Tories, particularly Anne Widdecombe, as an example, who are converted to Catholicism. And I know that there are moves in the hierarchy of the Church of England, which after all is Catholic or it's
Pope. Blair's a bit Anglican.
Exactly, Blair's that way himself. Mind you, I'd love to see him in confession, mea culpa, forgive me, Father, for I've sinned, because Ken Livingstone's now the Mayor of London.
She's saying we could have a Catholic papal monarch.
You could well indeed, yes. They could well restore England to the true, or the allegedly true, Roman and apostolic faith.
But isn't the Christian establishment very vulnerable now to the very vigorous Muslim attack on our
ideas? Largely depends where. I mean, certainly would be in the Muslim community, but I don't think the general public are very aware of either modern theology or its attack upon, if you like, Western capitalist values itself.
But wouldn't you?
But I think they're very frightened of Islam. Because Islam, if you look at it now, has now replaced communism as the big bogeyman.
They're very militant.
And exactly, they're very militant, they're proselytising, they proselytise with the sword as well.
Everywhere.
Which could be one of the reasons why they bumped off Diana, because if you had... Because she may remember that shortly before she died, she said she was going to make some kind of startling announcement. And some people think the startling announcement that she was going to make was that she converted to Islam. Now you can imagine, can't you, that she converted to Islam. She has a son who's a Muslim, and he's possibly in line for the throne if a few people pop their clogs. Then you think of the tremendous problems that would cause.
She'd been seeing an imam, hadn't she? Mm. Some Sufi or something.
But don't you think all this traditional orthodoxy is a load of baggage anyway, a load of excess baggage we don't want anymore?
Oh yes, I mean...
And the young ones, I mean, look at Australia, they're going to go Republican before long. And for the young ones in our midst today, don't you think that they've got to say, put two fingers up to all this, this baggage that we've got, and say, we've got to start again as a Republican?
Yes, I do, yes. I mean, but obviously, you know, you've got to remember that the British establishment is very clever.
By virtue
of the fact that it's existed for so long as it has, it's very clever. It's also very adaptable as well, very good at compromise. I mean, what we've got now in this country is in fact a compromise between the industrial capitalists and the remnants of the old feudal aristocracy, which was actually manifested in the Reform Act of 1832, when the industrial capitalists got the votes, and also when cities, industrial cities like Birmingham, become boroughs, and therefore the capitalists got control of local government. I mean, I don't think very few people nowadays believe any of the kind of ideological baggage of either Anglican or indeed any other form of Christianity or any other form of religion, except possibly various forms of paganism amongst some people. And indeed, in many ways, they have, by what they've done, put up two fingers to this. But of course, because the monarchy is both a religious as well as a political establishment, it has to carry on with this. Talking about Australia, I think the only reason why Australia isn't a republic now is the way in which the referendum was actually worded. And also because a lot of people didn't actually want the powers that the Governor General has, sort of going to professional politicians. They wanted them devolved. If it had been worded differently, I think Australia would be a republic now. And of course, one of the things that the good old British establishment did was transport whole loads of rebels and trade unionists, Fenians, Chartists off to Australia. It's quite interesting that apparently that at various times when there were strikes in the goldfields in Australia, the songs they sung were Irish rebel songs and Chartist songs. So that could be a beginning as well, and of course that would have big ramifications because our own dear Queen is not only head of state of this septic isle, she's also head of state of a whole number of Commonwealth countries as well. And if one goes Republican, then of course the rest could go Republican as well. And indeed, if, for example, Ireland was reunited, or Scotland broke away, then that would be the beginning of the end of this of the United Kingdom, which of course would be a good thing.
Thank you.
No, you've got 10 minutes.
Have you linked with the Republic?
I was actually one of the founders of it. Myself and a bloke called Albert Standley, who died about 6 years ago, we founded it. We actually founded it on a foggy evening in the bar on London Bridge Station. I don't have links with it now because I have political disagreements with it. Republic is basically, what Republic wants is a constitutional republic, which would basically be ruled by politicians and capitalists. What I want is a workers' republic, which would be ruled by the majority of the people, the working class. What that would entail, I think, is pretty much open to discussion. So my main affiliation at the moment is with the South London Republican Forum, which I started some years ago, which in turn has links with the various other Republican groups in Scotland, in Wales, in Ireland, and in England as well.
Because you know of the meeting at Mallet Street next Saturday?
I know of it, yes. I should actually be at another meeting in Cornwall Hill there at that time.
Because I'm a member of
that. Right, yes. Well, anyway, like I said, I mean, the South London Republican Forum, although it started out as a local group, now has members all over the place, so if you wanted to join us as well, we've got a full downstairs.
Yeah.
And we've got some pamphlets as well.
Yeah.
You said a reference to circumcision and the royal family, and you're saying that there isn't a Jewish influence. You made some reference to British Israelism, the idea
yes.
that the British royal family descended from
the kings.
Do you think, though, there is a Zionist political influence within the British royal family and the British state? I mean, I think in 1917-18 it was the British that helped partly set up the modern state of Israel.
At that time you're talking about when the old Turkish Empire, the Ottoman Empire, was on its last legs in the First World War. You had the Balfour Declaration, and of course Palestine was under a British mandate.
Yeah.
What the Balfour Declaration basically promised was a Jewish homeland in Palestine. In terms of British governments, it's gone various ways. I mean, Israel was established in 1948. We had a Labour government. A lot of people in the Labour Party, and certainly up to the present time, have been Zionists. As you probably know, there's a very influential group called the Labour Friends of Israel. Ernie Bevin, who was the first Foreign Secretary at the time, was very anti-Israel, and some people have accused him of anti-Semitism. In terms of the jugglings of world politics, I think the British establishment would tend to favour Israel because obviously it's a bastion of the West in states surrounded by hostile states which in the past have been very much influenced by the Soviet bloc. Nowadays are increasingly coming under the influence of militant Islam.
I think, you know, people like the Rothschilds and the Warburgs, you know, that obviously powers the royal family to a great extent. What do you think of that?
Well, obviously, I mean, these people have the money. And of course, in this society, money not only talks, it screams. So I imagine, yes, they would, and obviously as well, like I said, our royals are very much part of the capitalist establishment. As I said, the part of the origins of the present world lie in the fact of the battle between William and James, with William's being very much backed by merchant bankers, by financial capitalists, who got their hand on creation of money in this country through their control of the Bank of England. But I mean, certainly people like the Rothschilds and the Warbucks, their allegiance isn't to any particular country or even any particular ideology. I mean, I think their allegiance is to their own bank balance and their own power. And if it comes to overthrowing governments and replacing them with other governments, or kicking out monarchs and replacing them with republics, if it's in their interest, they'll do it.
To what extent does the modern British royal family go back to sort of the Norman yoke, you know?
Well, yes, I mean...
Is that a very significant moment in time?
It is, yes. I mean, as you might know, English radicals long had, particularly people like Thomas Paine, for example, and before him the Levellers in the English Civil War, had the concept of the Norman yoke. And the idea was that prior to the Norman invasion in 1066, you had what was called the free-born Englishman. Council, of course, in the old Seven Saxon Kingdoms, the power of the monarch in many places didn't really run that far. And there was a less of a sharp division between the aristocracy and if you like, the peasantry. And the idea was that when the Normans came over, they changed the situation, and what they basically introduced was feudalism, where the bulk of the peasantry became serfs, and very much under the control, and very much beholden to the local landlords, the local feudal barons, who were the fellow bandits of William the Bastard. And what the early radicals wanted to do was actually restore their mythological pre-Norman England. I think this is quite an interesting theory. Not good history, but it certainly gave people something to focus on as an opposition to the establishment and to the British monarchy. If you like, it was a useful piece of ideology. Of course, we can move beyond that now. But certainly the concept of free-born people who, by virtue of their existence, have inalienable rights, I think is quite a good one, and perhaps one we should revive as well. And certainly I am very much in favour of a very large measure of devolution and of regionalism, with power being devolved, and by being devolved being diffused. And what I would like to see is actually something like the old folk mood system of neighbourhood or village or what have you, councils, perhaps based on present electoral wards, or perhaps based on even something smaller, where it would not be impossible for the whole adult community to get together and collectively make decisions, particularly those which affect them in their day-to-day lives. Because the monarchy has always been a centralist and centralising institution which places more and more power into fewer and fewer hands. And the vision I have, one which is antithetical of that, of placing more and more power into more and more hands, so eventually nobody has any power at all, because everybody has power.
I think one angle that's been kind of overlooked, unless anyone's mentioned it, is the aspect of the Aryan connection. You're going back to the Normans there, but much older than that, 5th, 6th century AD, was King Arius. And from him, I think he was a northern European king, and from him comes the whole tradition of the Aryan descent. Now, the Hitler and the Germans thing, we know that they were very fixated with the Aryan ideal. And there was also a connection between some of the people in the high Nazi movement and some of the people in the high British aristocracy. One wonders where the word aristocracy comes from. Is it anything to do with the Aryan? One wonders whether the values within possibly a blood lineage of the Aryans is what would be the thing that would react most strongly to the idea of Diana's children becoming Muslims. It perhaps was that energy which made it such a fearsome possibility.
It's an interesting theory. I mean, as far as I know, the only people who ever actually were called Aryans or called themselves Aryans were people who lived northern India and spoke a language called Sanskrit. It had nothing at all to do with anybody who lived in Western or Northern Europe. And certainly there were very close connections between the Nazis and leading, well, in fact, of course, the Edward VIII.
Well, remember that you were saying earlier on, the Windsors came through from German
Yeah, that's right, from Hanover.
That must be what Hitler was respecting about.
Yes, and also as well, the Germans had this strange department, I forget what the hell it was called, but it investigated occult things and seemed to see all sorts of strange mystical significance in the fact that the British aristocracy wore top hats and the kids at Eton sort of wore bum freezer jackets and high collars that cut your neck off if you move too quickly. I mean, whether that proves that the Nazi movement is even more bonkers than most people think, I don't know.
But is there then a connection, I mean, is Aryan concept that with the British colonisation of India? Is that some...
Well, I think the British colonised...
Getting back to the roots or something?
No, I think the British colonised India because apart from the fact that the British would build an empire then, it was a useful source of raw materials. It was also a useful market on which you could... dumb British manufacturers, particularly textiles, and of course also as well it was a useful source of opium with which you could trade and also use that as an aid for colonisation as well. We fought a war with China to force the Chinese to take opium that the British had grown in India, and basically what the British did, they went into India, used the divisions between castes and religions and areas to, I mean, the British held India with about 40,000 men, which is a remarkable feat when you consider you've got this massive country of hundreds of millions of people, which they did by exploiting the divisions, buying off people, and of course the British saw it as a source of raw materials, the jewel in the empire, and as a place and as a useful tone market for their manufacturers as well. I think Churchill certainly regretted the loss of India as well. Even a lot of people in the Labour Party didn't want India to become independent. But I think all this stuff about Aryans, I mean, I don't think the British establishment has ever really gone in for that. I think what they've gone in for is a kind of idea that the British, by virtue of the fact they had a massive empire, conquered the world, forced people to adopt English as their main language, was the hub of empire, the hub of industry and all that. Almost like the ancient Israelites, almost like the ancient Jews, and they had some kind of strange covenant with God. That because, you know, they were God's chosen people, they could therefore assert their hegemony over the world. I don't really think anything to do with sort of German themes of Aryanism. So I think it's more a British theory of Britishness. Only ever follow the deathly silence.
Oh, well, thank you.
The information where unknown forces strike the edge of ecology.